Okay, it says qualify briefly. At this time, I'm supposed to qualify briefly. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday Night Speakers Meeting are 1 year continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers.
Hey, Jim.
My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. Central is my home group, and I qualify to be up here. I'm all over the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were reading something at noon today about, you know, if you just can't stop drinking, or once you take a drink, you don't know what's going to happen. And at the end of my drinking career, all I knew is once I took a drink, somebody was going to get hurt. And I didn't want to hurt anybody anymore. And I was able to come in here, find a God or a power greater than myself through you people, because I never had one before. I was not a churchgoer, and I'm not much of a churchgoer today. But I find this spiritual program can handle all my problems if I let God do it. So that's enough out of me.
Thanks.
The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off. We do record these speaker meetings here, so we don't want to record your dial tone or anything else. So check your phones one more time, and please refrain from moving around while the speaker is talking. And during this month, I got the privilege and the honor of picking speakers, and the lady that's going to speak tonight is somebody who I've known since I walked in the doors in 1998 in a little house next door to here. And she carries herself like a lady. When I first heard her speak, I said, that's a great story, but that's not her, because that's not the person I met. But I believe her, you know, because I've heard her speak before and after that. And I can tell you this, that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have something called an elder statesperson, or statesman is what they used to call it. But Mary, to me, is what the definition of an elder stateswoman is all about. So how about a warm welcome for Mary?
My name is Mary Parker. I'm an alcoholic.
Mary.
My sobriety date is November 27th, 1981. My home group is the College Park Triangle Group in Orlando. Meets Thursday night at 7 o'clock, St. Michael's Episcopal Church. Come and join us. Be on time and don't wander around the room. Kind of a tight group over there, but we get a lot done. I am very honored to be here and really appreciate the opportunity to participate in my sobriety. I came into Central when it was on Jackson Street, catty corner from a liquor store, which was incredibly convenient. And they served egg salad sandwiches for lunch. And since I was a little disturbed, eating lunch and not having to go anywhere was very helpful to me. I was telling somebody before the meeting, I would walk into the room and go, is that a hooker? I was really, you know, kind of naive. Turned out to be somebody who sponsored me later on, but that's okay. Just about right. But, was it? Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Got it? Yeah. All right. I was not an alcoholic from birth, but I was a weird kid. I was born in December of 1946, and next month I'll be 66 years old. I am almost 31 years sober, and for the young people who are ready to go to sleep, don't do that. I had a more interesting story than you because I've had more time to have it. So hang on your hat. My parents were normal people, by our standards anyway. My father was a World War II veteran. My mother was a housewife. They took good care of me. I was their first child, much wanted, much loved. No big problems, nobody drinking in my house, nothing that would say someday this girl's going to be speaking at an A&A meeting. I had two brothers after that. I don't know why they did that. I really think they should have stopped with me, but they didn't. And I was a weird kid. I was very, very, very shy and scared, anxious all the time. I would cry all the way to school, cry all the way home. But when I got there, I was viciously ambitious. And I don't know how those two things go together, but there was this girl in my first grade class who moved from someplace else, and she read better than I did because she had more expression. And I prayed for God to get rid of her, and he had her move. And that was my first experience with a higher power, and I really appreciated him getting her out of the way so that I could be best. I love to be best. I just don't want to work too hard for it. And I tried to work that out over the years. My father hated the cold weather. We were in Ohio, and he moved us to Miami, which was a magical, wonderful place back in those days. And growing up, I was with a lot of kids who are really super smart. Back then, we were in the space race. Sputnik, I know, you guys don't, it's over your head. But those old people in the room, you know, it was a space race. And so they divided us up into groups, and I was one of the smart kids, supposedly. I proved that wrong later. But I did really well in school, but my friends, I had two friends. One today is a doctor and a tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania. The other one's a psychologist in Marin County, California. So those are the kids I hung out with, and they were really intelligent. So I was just sort of hanging on to the edge of what they were able to do. But I knew that if I wanted to do anything with my life, I had to be educated and I had to get out of the house. Because my parents had, we were sort of hanging on to the bottom of middle class, sort of, or upper lower class. We just didn't have money. So there was no way that anybody was going to pay me to do anything. But I found out that I was a really crackerjack test taker. Now, when I finish, I don't know anything. But I can, for 2 or 3 hours, I can learn anything, and then it's gone. And that's a real gift in our society. You know, you learn something fast, you act smart, and then they give you money to go places to school. So that's what I did. And my friends were going to Emory and Brandeis and, you know, all kinds of cool places. And I ended up at a fine Southern Baptist university, which was a good place for me. Now realize, I haven't had a drink yet. And when I was in high school, I thought the boys who smoked got, I thought if you smoked, you got pregnant. So my information was really limited. It was really not a good thing. And so I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I didn't hang with girls who did, da 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 da. So I get to college, and I have a roommate from Washington, D.C. And she's in the room, and they assigned roommates back in those days at this fine Southern Baptist school. And I walk in, and she's got a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, cut off jeans. She's playing a guitar with long, dark hair. And I thought, why didn't I turn out like that? You know, in my little villager dress and my little Ouijans. It was just pathetic. Just totally pathetic. Still no alcohol. So my job, her name was Diane, and my job was to hold Diane's lovely long hair every night when she crawled up the fire escape. A fire escape, for you young people, is something you crawl up the side of the building to get into the room with. I hold her hair while she threw up, which she did every night because she drank a lot. I thought that was terribly cool. She went to fraternity parties, and I just stayed in the room and studied because I was so scared that they would send me home if I didn't have these great grades, which they would have, and they made that very clear. So this was going fine until I needed a ride home to Miami, and you put a thing up on the board and you find people, and I found this boy who was going to Miami, and he had a GTO. If you're a car person, it was the first GTO that came out, and it was, oh man, it was awesome. And he wasn't, but the car was. We are beginning the pattern of behavior now. So anyway, I'm waiting for something to happen, and he takes me home, and I'm not too attracted to him, though I would know what that meant anyway. I was very deficient in many areas, though I caught up, as you will hear. And he liked me. He liked me a lot. And so we started dating because that's what you do in the 60s in college. And so I dated him, and then he suggested we probably ought to get married. And I thought, oh, well, okay, that's next, right? And then his family suggested that I go on vacation with them. Now, my dad's conservative. My dad's, you know, not, his daughter doesn't vacation with boys. But these people, they were just filthy rich is what they were. It wasn't even wealthy. It was like over the edge. They were so rich. And they were, really, truly. I mean, my mother-in-law used to go to Paris for the collections. It was crazy. So they decided that they'd call my dad and see if we could cruise their yacht around the Bahamas. We know nobody with yachts. I didn't know where the Bahamas were. I mean, it was really bad. But they're persuasive people. They're used to getting their own way. So I was cruising a yacht in the Bahamas my junior year in college, and we got to Nassau. And walking down the street, we go to this bar named Dirty Dick's. I had the ashtray. I'm not making this up. That was the name of the bar. But it was like that little show and everything. So I go in, and my mother-in-law-to-be says to me, "Would you like a drink?" And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not that kind of girl, you know. And she said, oh, it's legal here. I'm like, well, legal? I'm all about legal. So what should I order? So she makes a suggestion, and I have a Tom Collins. Bunch of fruit, little umbrella, you know the drill. So I had one. It tasted really good. It was hot, no air conditioning. By the sixth drink, which I needed because it was hot and I was uncomfortable, did I mention I'm really a prolific reader? I read a lot, and so I had a vocabulary that I'd never had a reason to use, particularly the profane kind. And I looked at this boy, and I thought, he has some serious deficiencies which I need to point out to him in graphic terms. And so I took his physical inventory in front of his mother and father, and then I threw up. That was my first drink, my first six drinks. And they carried me back to the yacht, in the yacht basin. And that's how I started my drinking career. And so I thought, well, they'll probably send me back to Miami, but my parents couldn't afford an airline ticket anyway. So I was hysterical. I was crying all night. We got up the next morning, had a little family meeting. And of course, I'm just apologizing all over the place. How could I do such a thing? And my mother-in-law changed my life. She said, listen, honey, that wasn't you talking. That was the alcohol. I'm like, right on. That's what it was. So after that auspicious beginning, he gave me a great big diamond and we got married. And that seemed like a good idea at the time. Had a country club wedding. First time I'd ever been in a country club, but it was okay. And then we go back to Nassau on a honeymoon and get drunk for real, and that was okay by that time. And I wasn't throwing up so much anymore. And we start our life, and here's how it went. He had a very social family, a lot of community events and things, and so I would drink before we went out. And then we would go out, and then I would hit on an unavailable man, preferably married, but engaged was okay. And then he would yell, and then we would come home and fight, and the next morning I would be on the phone with him standing over me, apologizing to the woman whose husband or boyfriend I had hit on. I had a men's down before I ever got here. I'm really good at that. So one day he caught me in the kitchen. Scotch was my drink, and I would knock back like an 8-ounce glass, just quick. You know, it's just to, you know, prime the pump. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm having a drink. He said, why? I said, because we're going out tonight. He said, we're going to go out and drink. I said, I know, I'm drinking because we're going to go out and drink. And you all are going like this. You know what I'm talking about. Normal people don't understand the pre-drink drink. We do. You cannot go out unmedicated. You cannot, you know. So he didn't like that. And, of course, this wonderful marriage lasted 3 years, and I finally figured out what the problem was. Good for me, right? It was him. Crystal clear. So I left. I was so young, so young. I'm going, keep your money, keep your stuff, I don't want anything. So then I went to work, oh my God. But I'm a test taker, and I took this test, and I ended up working for a Procter & Gamble, big company out of Cincinnati, in their traveling marketing field. And so every week I get a telegram that tells me where to fly, and I fly someplace, and then I work there, and I can stop anywhere I want in between for free, and I can fly first class if coach is full. So I was the queen of the 60 seconds before takeoff reservation, because in first class you get free drinks, which I could have paid for, but just the idea, you know, just... So I got the free drinks, and once I got off in San Diego, I meant to get off in L.A., but they look a lot alike, trees, palm trees. But nobody ever caught me. And I was in Cincinnati, which is our home office, and I went to Columbus, which is where my parents are from, and met a boy. This one was not rich, but he was pretty. He was really pretty. And he was talented. He was an artist. So I thought, I'm tired of this work thing. This is not fun. So I convince him. He says to me the first night, takes me out in the hall to see if I look like bizarre or something, and I didn't, thank God, at that time. And he said, just one thing you need to know, I'm never getting married. I love a challenge, honestly. 9 months later, we're married. And then I tell him, we have to do something fun. So I took that big diamond and I sold it. And we went to Europe for 6 months just because, and Africa, and bummed around. And I'm drinking everywhere I go. I missed a few countries. I know I was there, but I don't remember what they look like. So here I am drinking, and then I get to Barcelona, and my jeans don't fit. And I mean, I'm packing a 40-pound pack and walking 10 miles a day, and my jeans don't fit. They won't button. And the girls are going, mm-hmm, I was pregnant. And so we get back to Columbus, Ohio, no offense, it's just not for me. And so we get back there, and I am stuck in middle Midwest hell, and I'm having a baby, and I have the baby, and I tell him, if we don't get out of here, I'm going to leave you. And like an idiot, he moves me to Florida and stays with me. And my daughter is and was just the love of my life, just precious. But it wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't enough. There was always something wrong inside of me. And when I started drinking, I just felt like I was enough, like I was going to be okay. So my husband gets a good job in an ad agency, and this goes on for a few years, and I'm getting bored, irritable, restless, discontent, and I know what the problem is. It's him. And so I start working for the Polk County Bicentennial Committee. That was 1976, for those of you not born yet then. And and there's a show. We're doing this show at that time, that, like a road show. And there's a guy who's an actor. He's like 6'5", and he's tall and has a very wonderful projecting voice. And I'm thinking, how about an actor? We've tried rich man, we've tried poor man. Let's try an actor. And so I thought, okay. So I let my husband know that we were done, just like that. That's what I was like. It, something out there was going to be better, and I knew I'd find it, and I thought it was a guy. So this one, I marry on February 29th, 1976, which I thought the anniversary only comes once every 4 years, so maybe I'd have a shot of hanging in there since I had a 3 to 4 year max. And we went on tour with the Polk County Bicentennial Touring Medicine Show. And we went from place to place in our motorhome. My daughter, though, was 3 by then, and she tells me today, Mom, that was the truck house. Get over yourself, you know. Sleazy. Told you it was sleazy, but the good part's coming. Anyway, so we're doing this. We're going from city to city to city to city. We drink every day. You pay the roadies every day. You lose a few every day. It was just craziness. And my ex, at this point, is getting tired of his daughter living on the road. So he meets me in Louisville Airport, picks her up and brings her home. Finally, that year is over. We come back to Orlando because I have a brother here, and I'm thinking, what to do? Time to take some tests, time to clean up, put on the navy blue suit, and look normal again. So I get a job almost immediately. I am a job getter, not a job doer, a job getter. And I get a job as the executive director of a parent education program at a college. They needed to work on their interview skills. So I'm doing that. And I'm just, life is just not going well. I'm getting bored and I'm getting miserable. And then the director, one of the board members of that program, comes to me and he said, you know, you shouldn't be doing this for a living. I'm like, I know. I don't like it. He said, I've got a good job for you. I said, what's that? And he said, how would you like to sell drugs? Legal drugs. I went into pharmaceutical sales. And I made a ton of money, and I was really good at it because my job was to schmooze doctors, and I'm very good at that. I'm good at schmoozing anybody, really. And during this time, all the controls were off, and I had money. And I was absolutely out of control, absolutely out of control. By this time, my husband was really getting tired of my shenanigans. I would go on a business trip and forget to come home. I would stay out all night. I would swear that I was going to have one drink at night, and then the next morning I would be so hungover I'd have to cancel appointments. It's amazing I didn't lose my job. My boss covered for me a lot. And finally, I decided I just had enough of this nonsense, and I told him I was going to a business meeting. Well, my business meeting was at the Why Not Lounge in Altamont Springs, because I like my business meetings. I have my navy blue suit on, and this guy and I had a discussion, and I didn't like the way it went, so I threw a drink at him. He threw a drink at me. I was a drink thrower. What a waste, as I look at it. Throwing drinks back and forth, and I stomped out screaming, as I would do, and I turned right instead of left. I lived in Rio Pinar, and I turned right, which is toward Apopka, and I was so flippin' lost, and I couldn't get home. Now, my daughter was at a daycare center that was open till 11. They had evening daycare. And my husband was working for the sheriff's department on the night shift. So it was my job to pick her up. But you see, after I have a sufficient number of drinks, I forget these things. Now, I didn't forget she was in daycare. I forgot she existed. She who is the most important person I've ever had in my life was not there for me, didn't exist for me. Because when I'm drinking, nothing outranks drinking, nothing. I'm not proud to tell that story, but it is my story. It's the story of an alcoholic mother. And it hurts me to this day to say that. So I pull into some weird little business in Apopka, and I get out of the car, and I take off my pantyhose and my purse, and I put them in the trunk, and then I hide in the bushes, waiting to be rescued. And a guy at 3 a.m. comes by in a Dodge Daytona with blackened windows. I've always liked guys in blackened windows, and they're interesting. And says, "Get in, babe." And I get in the car. And then I have a sane thought. I think he's probably going to kill me or do even worse to me. And so I began screaming at the top of my lungs hysterically. He wasn't as crazy as I was. He dropped me at the 7-Eleven, pushed me out of the car, and drove away. Now, back in the day, 7-Elevens were named so because they were open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. So I sat on the bread racks outside until somebody showed up the next morning, bummed some money from them, and then I went ahead and called my husband, who came and got me. And he was not happy. And that was the first time that I had any inkling that my drinking may have something to do with this. So I wrote a list, and here's what it said. It was my goals. I like goals. I want to be a good wife. I don't know how to do that. No idea what that means. I want to be a good mother. Clearly, no handle on that. And the third one, I want to stop drinking for 30 days. I might as well have written 30 years, because I had no idea how that was going to happen. But I forgot the list in a couple of weeks, and then I realized the real problem was him. Again, I just married inappropriate men, not my fault. And so I decided, the salesman showed up at my husband's office, and he asked if I'd like to have a drink, and I said, sure. We go down to his car, and he pops the trunk, and he's got a bar with Call Brands and ice in his trunk. And it was love at first sight. And we were meant for each other. And what I'll tell you about that is that if you find somebody that drinks like you do and you drink like I do, you will be rocketed into the fourth dimension. It's called hell. And we got together and it got really bad, really fast. And the end came, the miserable end came on Thanksgiving Day in 1981, my brother's birthday. And we went to Jacksonville. And we go to a bar, the kind you have to have your hand stamped. If you don't, you can't go in and out. So we go into this bar, and immediately I find he needs an inventory taken almost on an hourly basis. It's more than I can handle sometimes. So I begin explaining to him what's wrong with him. He gets mad at me. I throw a drink, which is my favorite thing to do, and he takes off. So I wait. Men do not walk out on me. This does not happen. No, 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 no. So I'm going to go out and explain all of this to him. And I go out, and a nice policeman is ducking his head into a Crown Victoria with handcuffs. And I try to explain to the cop how wrong he was. He was arrested for trying to get back in without his hand being stamped. This was a Duval County Sheriff's deputy. And he said, "Little lady, one more word out of you, and you're coming too." I'm like, "Oh, okay, I may be drunk, but I'm not stupid." So they take him to jail, Duval County, and I follow with my sister-in-law, hitting all the ATMs to get bail money. I have never known anybody that went to jail. I was like that goody-two-shoes girl that just drank a whole lot and married frequently and had affairs in between or during or whatever. But it was just men. So we get to the jail, and I'm trying to bail him out, but I can't because he won't speak English. Therefore, they can't book him. Now, he's an Irish Catholic boy from Chicago, so God knows what he was speaking. But he had a problem. I had a problem. We all had a problem. So I can't get him out. And I go into the restroom. You really should all go to a restroom in a jail just once for the experience. The silvering on the mirror is coming off. There's a smell of antiseptic and other that just is remarkable. And I had on this fetching little silk number that night. It was navy blue with some red on. I just remember my clothes. It's frightening, but I remember that. I looked quite lovely. A little red-eyed, a little bad there. And I looked in the mirror and I said, you know, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And the mirror talked back. It said, you're not a nice girl anymore. If you keep this up, you're going to die. It scared me. So we're driving back to Orlando and we agree we have to do something. This is not good. And I, of course, know the answer. I always know the answer. Mm-hmm. I'm full of answers. I said, therapy. We're going to therapy. Therapy is the answer. We're going to therapy. And I called therapists. Nobody would see us within the grace of God, nobody would see us during that period, during that two-week period. And he said, you know, I've got an idea. He said, my dad had a drinking problem, and he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, whoa, hold it. Let's not get crazy. You know, just a little bit too much to drink. But he is determined. He is going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I pondered this, and it occurred to me that what would happen is he would go to AA, and one of you alcoholic sluts would pick up my property and take it away from me, and where would I be? Divorced, single? No, I can't have that. I don't do that. So I had a plan. I decided to go to the meeting myself in disguise. That's what a cum laude education does for you. So I put on pants, baggy pants, a man's flannel shirt. I had buttoning issues in those days. I couldn't quite, you know, but I tried to get it buttoned, and giant sunglasses and a baseball cap, and I lurked into the meeting. I did. I really did. You didn't want to know that, did you? Oh, another friend lost. Anyway, so I do this, and I sit down in a chair, and this lady is beautifully dressed, just such a lady, comes up to me and says, hi, are you new? I'm like, how did she know? I thought for an AA meeting I was rather well dressed. So the meeting started, and they went around the room. I don't know what they talk about. God bless you people who remember the content of your first meeting, but I remember what I felt like. I felt like I belonged there. And they came to me at the end, and I said, and I'm a quick study, I said, hi, my name's Mary, and I always wondered what a drunk looked like. And I guess she looks a lot like me. And burst into tears for 5 years. And true. But I was not that much in love. I came once a week. I'm a busy woman. I have a big job. I have a house. I have a car. I can't be fooling around with you all the time. So every Wednesday I came to a meeting. And once I made the mistake of saying, you know, Wednesdays are my favorite days. And this old timer said, if you came to more meetings, you'd have more favorite days. So this girl named Jeannie that I found incredibly annoying invited me to go to a Tuesday meeting, which I thought was kind of cheeky of her, like, what's wrong with me, you know. But I went. And my boyfriend had been having a very rough time. He could not get divorced from his Al-Anon wife. She kept saying, let go and let God. I'm like, geez. I do the catch and release. I want to get the divorce and married. I just can't hang around for months at a time. But this chick was not playing ball. If I had known the amends that was going to cause, oh my God, never would I have done that. So the meeting starts, and a guy from Central actually was chairing the meeting. He was down at the old Navy base, and you know, he said, would you like to share? And my boyfriend says, he tells his tale of woe that he can't get divorced. And the chairperson said, keep coming back. It'll get better. And he picked up his chair and he threw it at him. Even in Central Florida in the 80s, this was uncool. Two big guys pick him up and sort of carry him out. And I hear them say, have you taken a third step, boy? The answer to that was a big no. So we get to about 3 or 4 weeks later. I'm still not a happy girl, and I decide that night I'm going to go drinking, that night that the chair throwing happened. And all of a sudden, these two people knock on our door. I'm looking for my purse. I'm getting drunk. I said, this is a noble experiment, but it's over. So I open the door, and it's the annoying girl, Jeannie, and her big boyfriend. And he takes my boyfriend in another room, and she says to me, you're going to have to find God, or you're going to die. She's from Tennessee. And I said, I'm sorry. I understand what you're saying, but I don't believe that stuff. And she said, I didn't ask you what you believed. I just told you what to do. And sponsorship was born. So Jeannie had me going to meetings, and the God thing made no sense to me. I just did what she said because I wanted her approval. That's the truth. Uh-huh. That's all. And one night, was a particularly bad night, and I don't know if you know what I mean by the roller coaster syndrome, but when I would go down in a certain way, the depression was so bad that either you kill yourself or you get drunk. There really aren't any other options that I was aware of. And it started, but she told me to call people. So I started calling people. One number, two, three. Nobody's, you realize, no cell phones. Very few people had answering machines. It was really like the dark ages, kids. But I couldn't get anybody on the phone. And I was really depressed. And I remember she said, there will come a moment where there's no effective mental defense against that first drink. That defense must come from a higher power. I'm an atheist at this point, you have to understand. But I thought, if Jeannie says it, I'm going to do it, even though I don't believe it. So I got on my knees and I said, God, if you're there, which I blanking doubt, do something. And he did. Right then, right there. I was in the presence of a power greater than myself that loved me and cared about me and wanted the best for me. And I was blown away. Well, and I didn't drink, and I didn't die, and I called her the next day, and I said, Jeannie, there's a God! And she said, we knew. Start writing. And she got me going on my fourth step and my fifth step, took me through the steps in a wonderful way, made me wait on some of the amends. I wanted to go back and be sorry to all the old boyfriends. No, we didn't do that. Well, for me, it's a lot of husbands, too, but we waited on some of that. And that should be, and she lived happily ever after, but you just don't know me if you think that. You know, my self-will was running riot, and I got about 3 or 4 years sober, and I felt like I had it together. And I want you to know, during this first 10 years of my sobriety, I never didn't go to meetings. Usually I came to Central every day and hit night meetings. I never wasn't in some kind of service. I never was unsponsored. I just chose sponsors that wouldn't irritate me too much and didn't expect me to do anything. I married the crazy boyfriend. Of course I did. You know, had a little AA wedding with little AA bridesmaids, little AA non-alcoholic punch, and a little AA church. It was precious. And my sponsor said, don't do it. And I said, you don't understand. God has brought us together. Suddenly God is speaking directly to me with no mediation from any sane person. Well, that marriage went downhill really bad, really fast. And I'm not going to tell somebody else's story, but suffice to say that it got really grim and dark and scary. And I didn't think I was going to make it. And I was back in pharmaceuticals. I'd stopped for a while. I went back because I needed money to get a lawyer to get a divorce. At least I remembered that much. And I wasn't telling anybody about this. And I went up to Pennsylvania for this training session. It's kind of an elite training group. And I got there, and it was snowing. It was February. And I had my head against the shuttle window. And I just said, God, I don't know if I can make it through this 2 weeks. I just don't know if I can do this again. I'm older. I'm scared. I'm tired. I'm unhappy. My daughter was in college by this time, and that's how I left it. And then I went back to the room, and I'm trained, so I called AA, said, I really need to get to a meeting. Can somebody come get me? Because I had no car. And they said, I'll call you back. And the guy was kind of unfriendly, and he didn't call. So I called again, and I said, look, I called earlier, and said, listen, Azita, I told you I'd call you back. I'm like, what? Who's that? So I decided Pennsylvania AA sucked, and that was the end of that. And I cried myself to sleep, and the next morning, we went into this room, and there were only 8 of us, and we all had these, like, really pretty brass nameplates, and I'm sitting directly across from me is Azita D. from Los Angeles, California. My eyes perked up. So I go up to her during our break, and I said, coolly, I said, hi, by any chance are you a friend of Bill W. and Bob? And she starts screaming, oh, my God, my sponsor said you'd be here. I'm like, who is your sponsor? And she mentioned some name, I don't know, in Los Angeles. I said, what are you talking about? She said, I'm 6 months sober and I knew I would drink. And she promised me God would send somebody. They sent me you. Oh my God. God was on having an off day that day. But we went to every meeting we could find. She was a tall, gorgeous Iranian girl and there was a little stumpy me. And we just tore up Pennsylvania. We had a great time together, and I remembered what it was to be truly sober. And I came back to Orlando, and I divorced that husband, which really needed to happen for both our sakes. We were killing each other, and here's the part I love to tell. I used to hate to tell it, but my friends are in the room. They'll love me no matter what I say. So during this time, I had a friend I mean a friend, not a wink-wink friend. And we used to go to lunch every day and talk to each other. We really liked each other, and I would set him up with girls, and nothing ever worked out. And so I divorced this husband, and he calls me up, and we had this experience. It's a long story, and he tells it better than I do, but he said, you know, we've never been single at the same time. And he said, there's really no point in dating since we've been going to meetings and going to lunch for 8 years. I was at his first meeting. My girlfriend and I said, loser, but he's cute. We did. And so he said, let's just get married. And there is a question I have never said no to. And the best part is he's a divorce attorney. How cool is that? You know? Done deal. So he walks, one of his friends walks me through my divorce to the guy I got sober with. And so we're done, and he come out, and I'm wearing my divorce dress. If you're me, you have a divorce dress. It's brown, it has ugly flowers. It's very unflattering, but the judge is very sympathetic when you wear dresses like that. He looks sad and depressed. So I walk out, and he said, you know, I've got 30 minutes before my next client. I'm a lawyer. I can get the paperwork. Why don't you just get married right now? I'm like, okay, whatever. So we go up, and little Kimberly, the court clerk or whatever she was, you know, pronounces as husband and wife. No rings, no flowers, no witnesses except her, no nothing. And he goes back, meets his client right on time, and I go to an in-service at a hospital in Leesburg. It was fabulous. So that night, just so the romance isn't totally gone from my life, I meet him at this restaurant that we really love that's closed now, Roman's up in Apopka. And so we get there, and the proprietor, the lady, is Mama. Everybody calls her Mama, and she comes in, and he calls her over, and his family's been going to this restaurant since it was open like 20-some years, and he says, Mama, I'd like you to meet my wife, Mary. We were married today. And she said, oh, that is so wonderful. He brings all his wives here the first time. True story. I couldn't make this crap up. So we start trudging the road of happy destiny. I acquired two stepsons, boys. I don't know what you're supposed to do with them. I have no idea. And I decided I wanted to become spiritual. So I was going to take a Thomas Merton course. I love to read. And fortunately the class had closed out, so I ended up taking a GRE prep course, the graduate record exam, and took the class and took the test and ended up in graduate school. And I became a therapist. I worked with couples. But they can't put anything over on me, trust me. And I made my sponsor a promise, and I've really kept it till this day, pretty much. I do not work with alcoholics. It is too close to home for me. And you all do that so well. I work primarily with people with serious medical problems. That was my gift, my feeling, my belief that I was given that. And when I started, I worked at a place called CENTAR, Central Florida AIDS Unified Resources, and I worked with the most wonderful people. Most of my clients died. It was before the good antiretrovirals were out, and it was an amazing, amazing experience that I could not have done without you. And then for a little break, I became a hospice counselor, and I specialized in young people who were dying. And that was the scared little girl, the one on the side of the street that just couldn't deal with anything, that would cry all the time and was afraid all the time. And you made me able to walk through my fear. I'm still afraid, but it doesn't stop me from anything, and that's just amazing. And but the time came to come back to Orlando, and I came back to Orlando, and my daughter was having her second child. It was a boy, we knew that, and went to the hospital, and I got to witness the birth. And when I was in pharmaceuticals, I was a NICU specialist, neonatal specialist, and so I had a lot of time that I spent in the neonatal unit. And I just didn't like the way he looked when he was born. I mean, he was retracting. His little chest was going up and down. He just wasn't good, you know. And I thought, oh, you're a grandmother. You're over the edge here. But as it turned out, the next day I went to see her in the hospital. And he examined the fingers and toes. You know how you do with a newborn. And all of a sudden, the toes were turning blue. I mean navy blue. I don't mean light blue. And that was going up his leg and going up his knee. And by that time, I can't exactly tell you. We're screaming. I'm running out of the room, getting a nurse. They're rushing this teeny little baby on a great big gurney down to CAT scan him and find out what's going on. It was terrifying. It was terrifying. And my daughter's crying. And the worst part was the hospital told her to go home. She'd been there too long. And so here's this baby in the NICU and his big sister at home. And everybody was so upset. And, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And she said, "Mom, I have to go home. But can you spend the night with the baby? Because we don't want to leave him alone even for a minute." So I had my black polyester pantsuit that travels anywhere. I had a bag of M&Ms and a Diet Coke. I am absolutely powerful when I had all that together. So I went in there and I sat in the NICU and held him and rocked him and talked to him and his little ragged breathing. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, the priest from our Episcopal church just sort of spontaneously showed up. And what you have to know is this was Easter, the night before Easter, Easter morning. And if you're not of the Christian persuasion, let me tell you, for Episcopal priests and high Episcopal churches, it's like the Super Bowl, you know, smells and bells and all this stuff. And it's big. And here he is in his jeans and a sweatshirt at 4 a.m. And I said, "What are you doing here?" That was nice. And he said, "I just felt like I should come and pray for the baby." I'm like, "Okay, that's good." So he prays for the baby. I didn't see anything special happen. And then he just seemed to be breathing a little bit better. And I looked. There's a window at Florida Hospital. There used to be in the NICU. And you could see the light, the first light of the first light of Easter morning. And I saw that. And I thought, that's nice. So finally, the parents, my daughter and her husband come. And the neonatologist comes and sends us all out. And I felt like we were gone for 2 hours. I'm sure it was 15 minutes. And he's examining the baby. And he was Peruvian. I'll never forget him. And he came out and he said, "There is nothing wrong with this baby. I will walk his weenie and I will send him home." And he walked his weenie and he sent him home. And he is 10. And the joy of my life. Just amazing. Just amazing the things I have been allowed to do. The joy that I have been able to experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And but it doesn't always go like that. You know, it's been wonderful, but it's been hard. I've lost my father in sobriety. And this summer was an interesting summer. I had what I like to call my adventures in breast cancer. I was diagnosed in July, had surgery in August. And that wouldn't be particularly remarkable, but it does remind me that I'm not alone anymore. And my home group has just been phenomenal. Phenomenal. And what else you need to know is, when I first got sober, my very first couple of meetings, there was a lady there who had a daughter who was in my daughter's class. And she used to bring a TV into the library of the church, and the two little girls, 9-year-old little girls, would sit there. And it meant so much to me to see a sober mother. You know, I didn't know what a sober mother was supposed to do. I didn't know what a sober mother looked like. And so I stayed in touch with her, and she moved, and it was kind of that. And I heard from her daughter a few years ago, the miracle of Facebook. I'm a major Facebooker. I'm crazy. And her daughter got in touch with me. And through that, I was able to see this woman again who had meant so, so, so much to my sobriety. And it was just wonderful. And so we connected. She's up in South Carolina. And not too long ago, just before I was diagnosed with cancer, this young girl got in touch with me and said, "I want you to know my mother has cancer. And she's fighting it, and she's on chemo, and we're very hopeful." And so when I was diagnosed, I let her know what was going on. And what I found out was that it doesn't matter whether you work a good program or a bad program. It doesn't matter that your sobriety is, no sobriety is better than anybody's. You've either got it or you don't. It doesn't matter where you go to meetings. None of those things matter. What matters is that you do what you have to do here, and you do it on a daily basis. And why I say that is that tomorrow I'm going to walk in this 5K with 12 members of my home group that I'm terrified to do. Usually I'm afraid to speak, but I'm more afraid of exercise than speaking. So, and my friend, who has been sober as long as I have and works as good a program as I do and has helped as many women, including me, has been put on hospice, and she's dying. And it could have been the other way around. It could have been her daughter sending me the email, my mom's going to be okay, and it could have been my daughter sending her the email, my mom's dying. I don't know why. And I don't think God picked me out to make it and picked her out not to. I just think it's hard out there sometimes. Life is hard. And it's important to know that you're not doing anything wrong if you're hurting or you're in pain or it doesn't go well. I hear that a lot. Well, God has a plan. He does, but we screw it up a lot. And it's not about that. It's about us being here. And what I know is that I can reach out to that young girl. She's a wonderful mother. She's a good wife. And my daughter is a wonderful mother and a good wife. And what this woman and I both got out of this deal is we are now beloved mothers. Me, the drunk that left her daughter and forgot all about her. We are beloved wives. We are women who can be trusted with children. We are women who are trusted in our community. We became the women that God meant us to be. And that doesn't happen overnight. That didn't happen for me for a long time. But I remember after that experience in the hospital with my grandson, I realized that the woman who could not be trusted to pick up a child at school, the woman who could not be faithful to any man under any circumstance, that woman spent the night and was the guardian of that child that night, that little boy. That doesn't happen. People like me don't get to do those things, but I do. And I get to do those things because of you. Because you taught me how to be a mother, how to be a wife, how to be an employee, how to give instead of get all the time. And I never, ever expected that. And I thank you for teaching me how to be the woman that God intended me to be and how to be a person that people are not afraid of or angry at all the time. I guess if I've gotten one thing, it's that I am not somebody that you have to be afraid of. And my little girl used to lock herself in a room with a TV dinner because mommy was scary. I wasn't abusive in the usual way. I was just scary. And today I babysit for her four children and take them places. And tomorrow my 14-year-old granddaughter is walking with me in this 5K. And I am known to be a person who's responsible. So if it doesn't go well for you right away, don't worry about it. If you don't have all the steps down in the first 15 minutes you're here, don't worry about it. And don't listen to people who tell you to keep coming back. Don't leave. Just stay. Just stay and stay and stay. Relapse is not a required part of recovery. If you have to do it, you have to do it. But too many of my friends never came back. So I want to thank you for being here for me. Thank you for your love and your prayers. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my life. God bless you.